since this launched its aggression on Gaza on 7th of October. Josep Borrell said lack of consensus among EU members about how to react to the conflict in Gaza has weakened the bloc's position in the region, preventing it from having influence on events. The EU foreign policy chief Borrell noted that the people of Gaza are in desperate need of food, water, medicine and healthcare. Beyond bombs and bullets, famine and epidemics are beginning to threaten the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Borrell said that some 1.9 million people, or nearly 85% of the population of Gaza, are now forcibly displaced because of the destruction left by the Israeli army's incessant bombardment of the territory. The top EU diplomat said, however, the European Union will firmly oppose any forced displacement of Gaza's population outside of the enclave, as proposed by some members of the Israeli government when they talk about getting rid of Palestinians of Gaza. Josep Borrell warned that European Union members that lack a united effort to end the conflict in Palestine may cause it to spread to already volatile regions outside, such as Yemen and Lebanon. Turkey's TRT World has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United Nations has said the Israeli war in Gaza is staining humanity on the eve of its 100th day, as the brutal assault has unleashed a humanitarian crisis in the besieged enclave. Since 7th of October, Israel vowed to destroy the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Gaza and launched a relentless bombardment campaign that has now killed at least 23,843 Palestinians, many of them women and children. An Israeli siege has sparked acute shortage of food, water, medicine and fuel in Gaza, where the healthcare system is collapsing. Visiting Gaza, the head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, Philip Lazzarini, said the massive death, destruction, displacement, hunger, loss and grief of the past 100 days are staining our shared humanity. Lazzarini warned that an entire generation of children in Gaza were being traumatized, diseases were spreading fast among the population, and the clock is ticking fast towards famine. The Hague-based International Court of Justice, the ICJ, this week heard arguments in a case launched by South Africa and welcomed by Palestinians of the Gaza Strip, accusing the Israeli regime of breaching the United Nations Genocide Convention. The case seeks a halt to the military offensive. The case seeks to halt Israel's military offensive on Gaza, which Israel claims is a form of self-defense. The Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a televised press conference, has claimed that no one will stop us, not The Hague, not the Axis of Evil, and no one else. It is possible and necessary to continue until victory, and we will do it, Netanyahu added. An Agence France Presse reporter in Rafah in southern Gaza has said telecommunications have been partially restored just a day after Gaza's main operator, Paltel, reported the latest outage in Gaza. Paltel did not immediately confirm the service restoration, but said an Israeli airstrike killed two of its employees in Khan Yunis while they were repairing the telecommunications network. Winter rains have exacerbated the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza, where the UN estimates 1.9 million people, nearly 85% of the population of Gaza, have been displaced. Many have sought shelter in Rafah and other southern areas of the Gaza Strip, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza.
Minutes. General Haj Qasem Soleimani, it's a name that has long sent shivers down the spine of the world's worst terrorists and their masters in the West Asia region, mainly the Israeli regime and the U.S., and surprisingly enough, continues to do so to this very day. When you get to know about the story of how the gifted general managed to mobilize the population of an entire region to fight against the Israeli occupation and Western imperialism, in the span of less than just 3 decades, you'll better understand why the U.S. decided to murder the general in early 2020, right after he led the fight against Daesh Takfiri terror group to success. General Soleimani was a nightmare for terrorists and their masters. General Soleimani led the elite Quds force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the IRGC, from 1988 up until the time of his assassination. But the fact of the matter is that he was not just an Iranian commander who made certain achievements and left. No, his character and strategy actually turned into a school of thought that is still the driving force behind the regional resistance movement and keeps shaking the foundations of the Israeli occupation and American imperialism even more strongly than before. His school of thought is actually still the driving force, the source of inspiration for the regional resistance axis against Israel. Let's take a quick look at his major achievements in a nutshell. Angered by the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the U.S. and its allies helped provoke an 8-year Iraqi war against the nascent Islamic establishment in the hope of destroying it. That plot, however, went down the drain thanks to the public mobilization and foundation of the IRGC and the brilliant role that its commanders, including General Soleimani, played on the battlefield under the guidance of the late Imam Khomeini. Later on, as part of the ideals of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the IRGC took on a more important role that exceeded the frontiers of Iran, and that was to fight against the main source of instability and insecurity in the broader Muslim region, namely Israel's occupation of Palestine and Western imperialism. When General Soleimani took over the Quds force in 1988, the genius strategist started using his military expertise and brilliant thinking to identify various resistance cells that were created by the people against any compromise with the Israeli regime. He then began establishing links between these various local resistance regional forces and created a network of them, thus giving identity to the ever-growing regional resistance axis that has since been a thorn on the side of the Israeli occupiers and their allies. In Lebanon, one of the pillars of the resistance axis, General Soleimani played a pivotal role in the Hezbollah resistance group's struggle against Israel, especially during the 2006 war, which dealt a heavy blow to the invincibility myth of the Zionist military and humiliated the occupying entity. During the 33-day war, General Soleimani was personally present on the battlefield and offered effective advisory assistance to Hezbollah, Lebanon's de facto military power, enabling the Lebanese to gain new victories years after liberating the southern region in an earlier conflict. Hezbollah has since continued to substantially grow its weapons arsenal, manpower, and intelligence apparatus. The group is seen as the textbook definition of a hybrid actor with conventional and unconventional warfare capabilities. It has also passed on its military knowledge to other resistance groups in Palestine and Syria as well. General Soleimani did a similar thing in Palestine. He offered training to the resistance forces and empowered armed struggles against the Israeli regime, especially the ones in the besieged Gaza Strip. Much to the dismay of the Israeli regime, General Soleimani managed to secretly break the tight siege that has been in place against Gaza since 2010 by facilitating the transfer of defense equipment to the different resistance factions there, before they acquired the expertise to develop their own. The Israeli regime has, over the past 13 years, waged several wars on Gaza with the goal of crushing the resistance movement there, but each time the Zionist entity has suffered an even bigger defeat than the last in the face of growing defense capabilities of the Palestinian resistance fighters. Today, the Palestinian resistance is not solely defending the homeland, but it's now on the offensive. General Soleimani's role in the victories of the Palestinian resistance against Israel better came to light in the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa Storm by Hamas against the occupying entity, which caught the regime's much-boasted spy services and military off guard. Humiliated by the surprise raid, the Israeli military has been conducting a campaign of destruction and ethnic cleansing in Gaza with the goal of, quote-unquote, wiping out Hamas. But it has so far achieved nothing more than the massacre of children and women. The general, however, rose to global fame due to his crucial role in the Syrian and Iraqi fight against Daesh from 2014 up until late 2017. Daesh was widely known to be a U.S. proxy designed to weaken anti-Israeli resistance in Iraq and Syria. The emergence of the terror group initially shocked the national armies of the two countries. The scary tech theories then moved to occupy land in the two neighboring states on the back of a campaign of death and destruction. General Soleimani, however, was quick and rushed to the aid of the two countries. He helped the Iraqi and Syrian national armies rebuild strength and also sped up the formation of popular groups to strengthen local militaries in the campaign against Daesh. The commander was present alongside the armies and the local resistance forces all throughout the battles and ultimately led their efforts to victory in late 2017. General Soleimani's strategies likewise inspired the Yemeni nation, a rather new member but exemplary member of the resistance axis against Israel and the U.S. The world watched in surprise how Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement defeated a Western-backed military campaign against their country by Saudi Arabia and a coalition of its Arab allies with empty hands. In parallel with its defense campaign, the Houthi Ansarullah movement continued to build military strength to the extent that today it is militarily and economically challenging the Zionist regime in solidarity with Palestine. All in all, what's unique about General Soleimani's strategy is that he detected and tried successfully to minimize the religious, racial, and ideological differences that has long been abused by the global arrogance to spread the seeds of division among regional states and further its own goals. After getting rid of such sources of division, the commander successfully managed to make the local resistance cells join hands and shatter the roots of occupation and colonialism in the region. Had it not been for the sacrifices of General Soleimani, the formation of the regional resistance axis would not have been possible. Today, the resistance axis led by Iran has been challenging the unipolar system sought by the U.S. in the world. Years ago, when Israel fired even a single bullet in the occupied territories, everyone in the region would grow fearful of the outbreak of a war by the invincible Israeli military. But today, thanks to General Soleimani, everyone has realized that Israel is truly weaker than a spider's web, as put by Hezbollah's leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. The U.S. assassinated General Soleimani to stop this trend, but what it failed to understand is that it would never be able to eliminate the school of thought and the legacy that the great martyr of Al-Quds left behind.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Human rights groups are saying the United States is complicit in Israel's war crimes by aiding it militarily and providing it with intelligence to help Israel target Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Online American news organization The Intercept has covered this story and tells us more. A recent document has revealed that U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is quietly providing intelligence to the Israeli regime for targeting purposes in the war-torn Gaza Strip, deploying U.S. Air Force intelligence engagement officers on the ground to the occupied Palestinian territories to help Israel conduct airstrikes and fire long-range artillery weapons at the population of Gaza. According to a deployment order obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and published by The Intercept, the Biden administration has been flying surveillance drone missions over Gaza since at least early November, ostensibly providing intelligence to the Israeli regime about captives being held in the Palestinian territory. At the time when the drone flights were revealed, U.S. General Pat Ryder claimed that the Special Operation Forces were not participating in target development. But several weeks later, on 21st of November, the U.S. Air Force issued deployment guidelines for officers, including intelligence engagement officers and airmen headed to the occupied Palestinian territories. The deployment guidelines were issued by the Pentagon's Air Force Component Command for West Asia, Air Forces Central. The document provides deployment instructions to air personnel sent to the occupied Palestinian territories, including an air defense liaison team, as well as airmen assigned to the intelligence engagement officer. The revelation comes at a time when the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, at The Hague, Netherlands, is opening hearings on a genocide case against the Israeli regime brought by South Africa. Experts say that a team of targeting officers like this will be used to provide satellite intelligence to Israeli officials for the purpose of offensive targeting. Lawrence Klein, who served as an intelligence engagement officer in Iraq before retirement, told The Intercept they're probably targeting people, targeting officers. Tyler McBrien, managing editor of Lawfare, a website specializing in national security law, said there seems to be an Israel exception to the U.S. rules around military assistance. Meanwhile, several progressive members of Congress have raised concerns that the United States' aid to Israel, both before and during the ongoing Gaza war, violates the so-called Leahy Law. The law, named after Senator Patrick Leahy, requires the U.S. government to vet foreign military units for gross violations of human rights when providing training or aid to those units. According to an investigation by the Israeli news website, Plus 972 magazine, the Israeli military intentionally strike Palestinian civilian infrastructure known as power targets in order to create a shock. Targets are generated using an artificial intelligence system known as Hapsora, the Hebrew word for gospel. The United States, Israel's biggest ally, has provided the regime with arms and ammunition since the war started on 7th of October. The U.S. House of Representatives on 2nd of November passed the standalone $14.3 billion military assistance package for Israel. However, the legislation is yet to clear the U.S. Senate. Amid simmering resentment across the region over America's support for Israel, which has massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella group of anti-terror organizations, has launched numerous missile and drone strikes against U.S. military installations in Iraq and in neighboring Syria. The New York Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. The New York Times report has quoted unnamed U.S. officials. The CIA has been providing intelligence to the Israeli regime on senior Hamas leaders and captives held in the Gaza Strip. According to the New York Times report, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan ordered the formation of a new task force to gather intelligence on the captives' whereabouts and Hamas leaders shortly after the 7th of October start to the war. It said Washington is spending many more resources on collective intelligence on Hamas than it was before the war, and is also carrying out more drone flights over Gaza to intercept communications between Hamas operatives. According to the report, the United States has already started transferring information to the Zionist regime on the location of senior Hamas leaders. However, it is not clear how effective this has been, and none of the major leaders in Gaza have yet to be assassinated or captured. The Israeli regime started its brutal military offensive against Gaza on 7th of October. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The American Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren says Washington needs to stop writing a blank check for Israel, since the Israeli regime continues to demonstrate an appalling disregard for Palestinian lives, particularly in the Gaza Strip. Senator Elizabeth Warren denounced recently the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden for unconditionally providing military aid to Israel. The Israeli military forces have massacred tens of thousands of innocent people, 70% of whom are women and children, since 7th of October. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote, "When it comes to military aid to Israel, the U.S. cannot write a blank check for a right-wing regime that's demonstrated an appalling disregard for Palestinian lives. The United States should use all the tools at its disposal to condition aid and move the parties towards a lasting peace." Senator Elizabeth Warren became one of the highest-profile Democrats to demand no further aid to the Israeli regime after Senator Bernie Sanders said the U.S. needs to stop being complicit in war crimes against Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. In a recent statement, Bernie Sanders said Israel's response to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm has been grossly disproportionate, immoral, and in violation of international law. He noted that Biden administration must no longer be complicit in destroying the lives of innocent Palestinian men, women, and children.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly TV show focusing on investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be highlighting how the growing public backing for Palestine in Britain contrasts sharply with the British political class who continue to give succour to Israel. One such example is the increasingly voluble support for Palestine on the terraces of Celtic Football Club. These displays of solidarity have been frowned on by the club's directors, and the Union of European Football Associations, usually referred to by its initials UEFA, has even imposed fines. Amina Taylor has this report about a group of Celtic fans known as the Green Brigade who display their solidarity with Palestine at Celtic's matches.
Back in 2006, a seemingly unlikely bunch of football supporters got together to create the Green Brigade. Styling themselves as ultras, they were a declared anti-fascist group and from the beginning championed the cause of Palestine. The green, in the title, refers to the hoops on the shirts of their football team, Celtic, a team created in 1887 with the purpose of alleviating poverty in the immigrant Irish population in the East End of Glasgow by an Irish priest, Brother Walfred. The cause of Ireland has always, therefore, been core to the politics of the Green Brigade. Their devotion to Irish republicanism and to the cause of Palestine have attracted attention and attempts to constrain and abolish the group, but all attempts have so far failed. In June 2012, a flurry of Palestinian flags flew proudly, and a banner appeared reading, "Dignity is more precious than food." This was a display of support for Palestinian hunger strikers in Israeli jails. "We did this in solidarity," they said. "We want Palestinians to know we're thinking about them and encourage Scottish civil society to look at the injustice in Palestine." In 2016, Celtic were fined £8,619 by UEFA for supporters flying Palestinian flags at an August 2016 UEFA match against Israeli team Hapoel Be'er Sheva at Celtic Park. The Green Brigade launched a crowdfunder to raise £10,000 to pay the fine, but in the end raised £188,000. They donated the balance to Palestinian charities. After the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood on the 7th of October, the Green Brigade did not shrink from action. That day, during the game with Kilmarnock, surrounded by Palestinian flags, their banners read, "Free Palestine, victory to the resistance." On the 25th of October 2023, thousands of Celtic fans, during a UEFA Champions League match against Atletico Madrid, flew the Palestinian flag and unfurled the same large banners that read, "Free Palestine and victory to the resistance." Fans dedicated the song "You'll Never Walk Alone" in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. In response, Celtic suspended the season tickets of Green Brigade members, effectively banning them from the game. In November, UEFA fined the club £15,200 for the Atletico Madrid action. The Israel Football Association took credit for the complaint that led to the fine. However, the Green Brigade returned triumphantly to Celtic Park on the 23rd of December last year and amidst a sea of banned Palestinian flags, unveiled a banner quoting a section of a prisoner's Christmas song. "Many homes, they are sad tonight. They whisper someone's name by the candlelight. 20,000 plus killed, 8,000 plus children. The spirit of resistance is strong in Celtic Park, as it is in Gaza. All power to the Green Brigade."
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest contributor today is Steve Headley, who joins us via Skype. Steve is from Derry in the north of Ireland and is a lifelong socialist and trade unionist who was the senior assistant general secretary of the RMT trade union until quite recently. He's also been an anti-racist pro-Palestinian activist all his adult life and is a lifelong Celtic fan too. His book, Derry Boy, will be published at the end of the month, and having had a sneak preview, I can tell you it's a compelling read. Welcome to the show. Steve, let me start with you. I mean, you grew up in Derry, as we've just said there, with an appreciation of the Scottish-raised Irish Republican leader, James Connolly. I wonder whether you can explain for our viewers how the Irish question and Celtic FC are intertwined.
Well, Connolly was actually a Hibernian supporter. He was instrumental, a big Hibernian fan, which was another Irish team in Edinburgh. But the link with the Palestinians and the Irish diaspora that settled all over Scotland and indeed all over the world is that we were oppressed people. We were dispossessed people. For hundreds of years, Britain had sent in settlers to Ireland, taken our land, tried to have a genocide by a so-called famine that was stealing our food. So we naturally, as an oppressed people, sided with other oppressed peoples like the Palestinians. If you think that the in the 1840s, the Irish were fleeing and dying in their millions, we see that exactly as what's happening in Palestine now, and we want to show utmost solidarity with those people. And the people in Celtic Park, the Green Brigades and the Celtic Ultras and others, a large crowd outside of the Green Brigade, support Palestine 100% and do everything in their power to raise the issue of the Palestinians.
Well, David, just say a little, will you, about the connection between Glasgow and Palestine, and how is it related to the Irish question?
Well, so, I mean, Glasgow is about 30% Catholic, almost all of Irish origin, and who regard themselves as being Irish and of Irish origin. You can see it in the flags and in Celtic Park and in the colour green. And so that's the key connection. And, of course, as Steve's been saying, it's a common sense of oppression. But, and I would go further than that because, of course, you know, what's happening in Palestine is a settler colonial problem. And, of course, the issue in the north of Ireland is a settler colonial problem. The fact that Britain still remains part of the north of Ireland and is still not decolonised Ireland fully is the reason why there's still an actual issue in the north of Ireland. So people in the north of Ireland, naturally, Republicans there, naturally regard the question of Palestine as something which is core to their sense of being. And so, of course, it's not surprising that you find the Palestinian flag flying amongst Celtic fans. And you don't find it flying amongst Rangers fans just across the city in Glasgow at the other end of the city, because that's largely a team which comes from the Protestant and imperial tradition. So there's the difference.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I mean, the banners at Celtic Park supporting the resistance are the kind of things which people have been arrested for in today's increasingly censorious climate, aren't they? I mean, what do you think is happening with dissent over Palestine in this country?
Well, I think there's been a deliberate attempt to oppress all dissent, and not even that, but even news about Palestine, real news. And if we look at, there's now been over 100 journalists killed in less than 2 months in Palestine, and you know what people are doing at Celtic is try to get that news and raise the profile of Palestinians. And we are in a position where we're slipping into authoritarianism. We have this ridiculous spectacle where people who are quite happy to see children blown up and mutilated every night on their TV suddenly find the phrase "from the river to the sea" is somehow that inspires terror. But seeing children blown up, they don't want to call for a ceasefire, but that phrase, "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," we're told inspires terror in people. And I don't believe that. I think it's a deliberate attempt, one of the many attempts, to actually oppress freedom of speech. And if we're not careful, we're heading towards a very authoritarian regime if people can't express their freedoms of speech in this country.
No, indeed. I mean, he's absolutely right there, isn't he, David? But it's not actually illegal, is it, to support the resistance? And we're seeing all these arrests and clampdowns. It's rather odd, isn't it?
Well, so there's a contradiction, isn't there? Under international law, there is a right of an occupied people to armed resistance. Yes. So resistance, including armed resistance. And that's a right which the people of Palestine clearly have under international law. Yeah. But under terrorism legislation in the US or the UK, there's a number of organisations which are listed as being, quote, terrorist, and you cannot support them explicitly because that would be a crime under the Terrorism Act, right? But, of course, not all the Palestinian resistance factions are on the list. So there's some you can support. The DFLP, for example, Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, isn't on the list. But more broadly speaking, of course, what resistance refers to, including armed resistance, is a wider question of a movement in Palestine. Hamas itself is called the Islamic Resistance Movement in Arabic. That's the name of the organisation. So there's a sense in which resistance, calling for resistance, even armed resistance, is not the same thing as supporting so-called terrorism. And of course, but the contradiction is something which has to be worked upon. So Steve's talking about from the river to the sea as being regarded as being somehow genocidal and supportive of terrorism. But of course, people are not being dissuaded by that argument. And what will happen, really, is that the more that people say there's a right to resistance, the less it will be possible to prosecute people for that.
No, indeed. Well, Steve, I mean, what's your experience of trade unions offering solidarity with Palestine?
Well, look, Chris, I'm going to be brutally frank here, and I think that when trade union leaders get up and wax lyrical and indeed just announce their union policy of supporting Palestine and calling for an end to genocide, that's wonderful, that's great, but what's it actually achieving? We have the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, which has got RMT members now in it, in the Red Sea, supporting a genocide. Now, those members aren't supporting a genocide, but the leaders are doing nothing about balloting those members and instructing them not to work. Similarly, you've got members of UNITE, members of the GMB, who are involved in technological firms and even arms manufacturers that are selling goods to Israel, which is enabling that genocide. And again, we have these same people getting up on stages in front of thousands of people, getting clapped when they say that we should stop the genocide. What are they actually doing about it? You know, the rhetoric doesn't actually match what's going on the ground. The rhetoric doesn't match the reality. So I think that the trade unions, it's incumbent upon trade unions. This isn't a matter of what's legal or illegal. It's a matter of what's right or wrong. Are we going to stand like the Nazi war criminals, and just say, well, we were just following the law, we were just doing our job? Are we actually going to try to stop this genocide, which is happening on our watch?
Yeah. Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment. Just to next report now about Celtic's namesake that was established in Palestine in 2019.
Aida Celtic is the name of a football team which grew out of the Palestine solidarity work of the Green Brigade. At the infamous match against the Israeli team Hapoel Beersheva in 2016, UEFA fined the club a total of more than £8,000 for the crime of flying hundreds of Palestinian flags. These constituted illicit banners. The Green Brigade launched a hashtag on Twitter, hashtag match the fine for Palestine. From Gaza to the West Bank, Palestinians showed their support and thanks for the campaign. Photographs of children and medical volunteers displaying the hashtag appeared. Video messages from Aida camp in Bethlehem filtered through. A Gazan football team posed alongside a "Thank you, Celtic, love from Gaza" banner. These actions laid the foundation for a legacy beyond the campaign. Donations flooded in from all over the world. The initial target was quickly surpassed, and more than £180,000 was eventually raised. The money was divided between medical aid for Palestinians and the Laji Center from Aida refugee camp near Bethlehem in the illegally occupied West Bank. Aida Celtic, a football academy, was launched in 2019. Since October 7th, Aida Celtic have faced harsh challenges and the solidarity has continued. According to an academic study, Aida refugee camp is the most tear-gassed space on Earth. On November the 26th, over 100 tear gas canisters were fired into the camp, many landing on the football pitch. On October the 25th, the poet and writer Dr. Rafat Alayer posted on X, "The bombs are falling as I am writing this. Celtic fans are amazing. Thank you from Gaza, from under the Israeli bombs. Your solidarity means a lot to us." In December, fans were quick to point out that Dr. Alarer had been murdered by the Zionist. At the end of November, WHO staff member Dima Al-Haj was murdered alongside her husband, their six-month-old baby boy, and her two brothers. Over 50 family and community members sheltering in the same house also died. Al-Haj was a former Glasgow University master's student who had been in close touch with Celtic fans. At 1 in the morning on the 10th of December 2023, occupation forces invaded Aida camp and broke into the Laji Center to remove the Palestine flag, which proudly flew from its roof. The flagpole was cut with an electric saw and stolen alongside the flag. The pole was later installed on the occupation base, which overlooks Aida camp, flying the Zionist flag. By Sunday evening, a new Palestine flag was proudly flying from the Laji Center roof once again. As Aida Celtic posted in response, they have nothing in their whole imperial arsenal that can break the spirit of one Palestinian who doesn't want to be broken.
David, the Green Brigade, they're excoriated, aren't they, in certain quarters? And yeah, they played a blinder, didn't they, in the development of Aida Celtic?
Yeah, so they did this hashtag and they raised all this huge sum of money, which more than 20 times almost paid the fine.
Yeah.
And they gave all the rest of the money to Bedouin Palestinians and to create this club, which, of course, now is a going concern in Aida camp. Which, of course, as we've seen, is the most heavily tear gassed place on earth. It's said. So this was an amazing way of turning around this you support terrorism kind of argument into sort of saying, well, actually, there's this practical solidarity coming from Glasgow, which is actually aiding the resistance in the West Bank against the Zionists. So, I mean, extraordinary. And it led to a huge outpouring of celebrity support, musicians giving them money, of course, the special football strips that they've done with the Palestinian flag and the Celtic strip, and, of course, the logo of Primal Scream, the Glasgow band, with Irish connections. So all of that is part of the mix.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I mean, what was your take on Aida Celtic and how this experiment has actually gone?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I think that the Palestinians now recognise that the support they're getting from the Irish diaspora and the people in Glasgow who are supporting Celtic. And I think it's terrific. I think resistance isn't just about violence and actually the occupied people's right to oppose the occupation. It's also cultural. It's also through sport. And whatever form it takes, wherever people come together in large numbers, like football teams, then the resistance is what happens, and resistance to the Zionist occupation. And I'm absolutely, absolutely so proud that my club Celtic had a hand in aiding that resistance in Palestine by giving all that money that they raised. UEFA tried to stymie resistance in Celtic Park, and what happened is resistance sprung up in Palestine because of that, because of the funds that were raised, and I think that's magnificent.
Yeah. Meanwhile, of course, David, the Zionists have been actively trying to subvert the Green Brigade, haven't they?
Yeah, so the Israeli Football Association made the complaint, which led to the fine, which led to them having the hashtag campaign, which led to the fantastic work that they've done in the West Bank. And, of course, the Zionists then under Alex Aflad, we saw in the film there, I mean, that 1 o'clock in the morning, breaking into the football club, taking their flag, taking the flagpole, and then using the flagpole to fly the Israeli flag in the occupation base overlooking them. I mean, how ridiculous is that? It's incredible that the occupation stoops to that kind of thing. But we've seen this time and time again in the last 3 months, the humiliation, the theft of people's things, even that case of the British IDF, so-called IDF, soldier rifling through the lingerie drawer of a Palestinian woman. Absolutely incredible the depths to which the Zionists are stooping.
No, indeed. Well, Steve, it seems that the Aida camp is perhaps the most tear-gassed place on earth. And, I mean, what should we make of the Zionist attacks on refugee camps and children's football?
Well, look, Israel is just a rogue state now, and it's a rogue state that's getting backed by the United States. And what we see is just incredible things. I mean, they're gassing people and gassing children at the football. They're murdering children. 8,000 children now are dead in Palestine. And we see the United States backing this. The United States, Biden's crying crocodile tears. He could cut off the money at any stage. He just needs to stop funding Israel and it would stop. So this pretense that America are somehow trying to intervene in a good way is just a pretense. It's just to buy time. But I think that what is remarkable, and I grew up, by the way, in Derry, getting tear gassed by the British Army, and they would go round indiscriminately gassing people in the Bogside and the Craig and other nationalist areas. So again, that's why we support Palestine, because we've experienced it ourselves. And I think that the more you oppress people, the more they fight back. For every person that they've killed in Palestine, there's going to be 10 people, their family or their friends, who are going to want to pick up a gun and resist. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. So what Israel are doing is everybody they oppress, everybody they gas, they're digging their own grave.
Oh, indeed. And the images of the occupation soldiers forcibly removing the flag and the flagpole, it kind of suggests a sort of level of, well, can we put it, contemptible pettiness, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen a veritable catalogue. I think even those of us who have known and thought that Zionism was genocidal from the beginning have perhaps been surprised by the level of pettiness and sheer brutality and the parading of men in their underwear, and forcing them to denounce Hamas, the shooting of people waving white flags as they try to move in the direction they've been told to move by the Zionists. I mean, it's truly despicable. And the levels of brutality, of contempt that you see in the propaganda. I mean, the example of the four women who are held by the resistance factions who have been and the resistance has been denounced by all these Zionist propagandists saying these poor girls are held by the evil Hamas. And of course, what they're failing to know is that these are women who are active duty military officials who are soldiers who have been taken as hostages or prisoners by the resistance factions, and we see no understanding from the Zionists that what they're doing here is a brutal genocidal occupation and it needs to stop, and there is absolutely no understanding of that displayed by almost any Zionist in the UK, the US, or anywhere else. And that's a sign, really, of a depth of misunderstanding that the Zionists have revealed. They do not understand the horrors that everyone else sees. And that's why, of course, Zionism must be totally ended as an ideology.
No, indeed. I mean, I saw just before we went on air, you get more images of Palestinians being stripped and held and, you know, humiliated in that way. But I just wanted to return back to, if I may, to the Green Brigade, because, I mean, you know, as well as holding banners aloft, you know, proclaiming support for the resistance and so on, I mean, it seems in many ways that, you know, they're making a more of a significant political stand than the official Palestine Solidarity campaign.
Yeah, so you saw some of the banners there. I mean, End Zionism is a remarkable one, really, because in the official Palestine Solidarity movement, we cannot talk about Zionism in an open way. We can't talk about ending Zionism, and we can't really talk, in the end, much about genocide. So the politics of the Green Brigade is way in advance of the official Palestine Solidarity movement attached to this Palestine Solidarity Committee. Now, of course, in Scotland, as you'll recall, we've had Mick on from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. The Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign is of a piece with the Green Brigade, much more advanced in its politics. And what we need to see in the Palestine Solidarity Movement is a move towards a much more militant sense of solidarity with Palestine, and no mealy-mouthed stuff about oh, we can't talk about Zionism. Zionism is a genocidal ideology. It has to be removed and destroyed from the world, and we have to do that by resisting wherever it is. And the Palestine Solidarity Movement, it seems to me, could learn some lessons from the Green Brigade.
Indeed. And I think the grassroots support is moving well ahead, isn't it, of the official campaign. But unfortunately, we're going to have to draw the discussion to a close now because we're right out of time. I'd like to thank our guest, Steve Headley, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. Until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Private sector activity in the Eurozone has worsened at the end of the year, raising the possibility that the region may experience a recession soon. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Financial Times has covered this story and tells us more. According to economists, lower public spending is set to curb Eurozone economic growth next year as the bloc moves into an era of budget restraint, putting pressure on rate setters to loosen monetary policy. Recently, the European Union finance ministers agreed to new fiscal rules that replace strict but hard-to-enforce budget constraints that have been suspended since the pandemic hit in 2020. The measures will phase in tighter spending curves, forcing higher debt countries to lay out plans to decrease their debt deficit and set a ceiling on annual expenditure agreed on in Brussels. Lucretia Rachlin, a professor at London Business School and former Director General of Research at the European Central Bank, the ECB, said the new rules will still be restrictive, and for countries with high debt like Italy, that is bad news. Economists expect a jarring end to almost 3 years of supportive fiscal policy in the European bloc, as the return to more restricted government spending further squeezes weak demand and activity. The Eurozone economy contracted 0.1% in the third quarter of this year, after stagnating for most of this year. Jack Allen Reynolds, an economist at Consultants Capital Economics, said the new European Union rules would be more strict by requiring high-debt countries like Italy to cut their budget deficits faster, but also more lenient in allowing countries to reduce debt levels more slowly. Some fear the shift could even mark a return to pre-pandemic situation in which the European Central Bank had to shoulder most of the burden for economic stimulus, forcing it to resort to negative interest rates and large bond purchases to ward off deflation. Recently, the European Central Bank brought forward the timing of when it expects countries to repeal support measures that were ushered in to counter the recent jump in energy and food prices, forecasting a sharp tightening of the single currency bloc's fiscal stance in 2024. The European Central Bank forecast the overall budget deficit of the Eurozone countries would shrink from 3.1% this year to 2.8% next year. That contrasts with a much more expansionary stance in the United States, which the International Monetary Fund expects to have a budget deficit of 8.2% this year and 7.4% next year. Konstantin Veit, a portfolio manager at investor PIMCO, said the European Central Bank may struggle to boost economic activity. Konstantin Veit said, "We might end up in a situation again where governments are not investing enough and the European Central Bank has to do more, but monetary policy ends up pushing on a string." According to Consensus Economics, economists have cut their 2024 economic growth forecast for the euro area from 1.2% at the start of the year to just below half a percentage point. The European Central Bank recently cut its 2024 economic growth forecast to 0.8%, down from 1% previously. The average forecast for Germany's economic growth next year has fallen from almost 1.4% at the start of the year to below 0.4%. Many economists have cut their forecasts after recent court ruling, which Tomasz Wielodek at T. Rowe Price said would create a fiscal drag of 20 billion euros to 30 billion euros next year for the EU's largest economy. Martin Wolberg, an economist at Generali Investments, recently cut his forecast for Germany's economic growth next year to only 0.1%, warning the country's budget crisis will have a negative economic effect primarily by a hit on confidence. Martin Wolberg added, damping down euro area growth, it will at the margin increase the willingness of the European Central Bank to embark on an interest rate cut. Minister for Public Expenditure and President of the Eurogroup of Finance Ministers, Pascal Donohue, told reporters recently that the EU's recent rules were undoubtedly going to have an impact on the fiscal stance in the eurozone, which he described as restrictive in 2024. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Private sector activity in the euro area worsened at the end of the year, raising the risk that the region may experience a recession soon. Standard & Poor's Global's Purchasing Managers Index contracted for a seventh month in December, falling to 47. That defied economists' expectations of a slight uptick, though they still predicted that the gauge would remain well below the 50 level that marks expansion. Readings for both manufacturing and services showed a slump. Hamburg Commercial Bank chief economist Cyrus de la Rubia said the figures paint a disheartening picture as the eurozone economy fails to display any distinct signs of recovery. Cyrus de la Rubia added, the likelihood of the eurozone being in a recession since the third quarter remains notably high. Recent numbers, which also showed that inflows of new business fell sharply, chime with indicators and data that suggest the region's contraction in the 3 months through to September saw a repeat in the final period of the year. Still, the European Central Bank's latest forecast, published recently, predicted a slight improvement in the period. Similar to the overall trend, separate Purchasing Managers Index for Germany and France showed the downturn worsened in the euro area's two biggest economies. German bonds extended gains and the euro fell after the figures were released. Traders added to bets on European Central Bank interest rate cuts next year after the softer data, pricing 155 basis points of monetary easing. That's down from about 150 basis points on Thursday, 21st of December. Bloomberg Economics said the survey suggests the broader picture is one of an economy still contracting that creates downside risks for our forecasts as well as the European Central Bank's forecast and should keep market expectations for an interest rate reduction before June alive. Geopolitics, customer reluctance, and the European Central Bank's battle against inflation were cited as reasons for the subdued performance in the German economy. Standard & Poor's Global said uncertainty about the country's public finances after a landmark constitutional court ruling sparked a budget crisis may also have weighed in on economic activity.
Economic Divide.
The U.S.'s really genocidal war continues to claim lives. Meanwhile, Israel is unraveling on a variety of fronts. One of those fronts is the food industry. Israel is coming up short, especially when it comes to food items. Well, the Israeli Food Association has even described it as a crisis.